Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. Sitting across from me is
the beautiful and talented Mike Cosentino.
That's
right.
Whose body parts are completely repaired. And we have two people in the studio with us today. Gary LeMaster.
Good morning.
And my brother, Chuck Williamson.
Good morning, everybody.
Gary is a descendant of the Clanton family, so we're gonna talk about the Clanton version of OK Corral at some point.
I'm more of a shirt tail relative.
Yeah, shirt tail relative. All right. We're gonna talk about a very odd topic today. We're gonna talk about Arizona and, how it was founded, what its, a history of its economy. Chuck's gonna talk about that. Gary's gonna talk about a lot of statistics about Arizona, the poverty, the amount of the food, the economy. And Mike is going to talk about Arizona and education because, as we say so many times, there's nothing more important than education. So how does Arizona get formed? Well, it's part of Mexico, basically, and it's conquered in the Mexican-American War in the mid to late 1840s. The United States defeats Mexico. American troops go all the way to Mexico City. They force Mexico to cede not only most of Arizona, but most of New Mexico, Southern California, Utah, and pretty much any place in between. Arizona becomes Arizona, through military conquest. There's a piece missing of Arizona. And that's the Gadsden Purchase. So Americans are not happy that they didn't get all of Arizona, and they forced the Mexicans to sell for a measly $10 million, the entire large part of southern Arizona. We were talking about earlier, we don't even know where the name Arizona comes from. I read that it was a Bass name, meaning place of oaks. Chuck, what did you read?
Well, they were attributed to a Tohono O'odham word and a previous Native American word, and so the Arizona Central website has about four different explanations, and I found even others.
When you get four different explanations, is they don't know, right?
Right.
You know, what I saw a bird; it was either green or it was red. You know, there's a problem. You know, you may be colorblind, but if you're not, you didn't really see what color it was.
Well, good. Let's change the name. I've never that crazy about it anyway.
Yeah. And so we live in a state, and we're going to talk about something we've never done before. We're going to talk about being in Arizona today. And we're going to talk about it from a lot of different aspects. So Arizona is conquered from the Mexicans. Tucson is a Mexican town, really. Americans pour in. The military complains that everybody that they that the vigilantes ran out of San Francisco ends up in Tucson, and Burke, who's an officer with Greg, said they're just waiting for them to shoot each other, you know, to eliminate the problem having them around. So when the United States acquires Arizona, it acquires a war between the Apache peoples and the Mexicans. And that war continues for dozens of years, and all the famous names, Cochise, Geronimo, Victorio, are chiefs of the Apache. The Apache are a raiding people. They're hunting and gathering, but they do raid. They made enemies of all the native folks living here. They made enemies of the Mexican. There's a slave trade. If the Mexicans capture the Apache kids, they sell them into slavery in Mexico. The Apaches abduct children and stuff. It's a brutal affair. And there's almost no fighting as we imagine, you know, in the movies. It's all massacres and ambushes. And the Apaches massacre a stagecoach, and then the Americans turn around and massacre a bunch of Apaches. And it's usually the women and children, old men who can't get away. They surprise camps. So there's this bloody warfare. And on one side, there are the settlers who are calling for genocide. They want the newspapers in Prescott and the newspapers in Tucson are calling for the extermination of the Apache, killing them absolutely to the last man. The settlers don't seem to care, and sometimes the military don't seem to care whether it's the people actually involved in an attack or not. If you're Apache, they want you dead. So you have this conflict between the military, whose orders are to suppress the Apache and but force them onto a reservation, and the settlers who want them all dead, and the Apache who see their lands taken from them. So what happens when you send in an idealistic officer to a place called Camp Grant near Tucson, who's an abolitionist? He fought in the Civil War, was wounded. After the war, he's reduced in rank when he wants to go back into the military permanently to lieutenant, and they put him in charge of a fort. A few Apache women come in. He's kind to them. He gives them food. He talks to them. And he gets eventually 500 Apache to surrender and live next to the fort. He asks them to go to a reservation, but they don't want to do it. A lot of times you see the really instability is just complete ignorance. They'll put two people who have been at war with each other for God knows how long in the same reservation. It starts out fine. So Camp Grant. So everything is going fine. But there's always problems. And there's always an economic underlier on this. So people who are supplying the reservation do not want the Indians to be independent. They don't want the Apache raising their own crops and stuff because then they won't be able to sell tons and tons of stuff to them. So Camp Grant massacre. What happens is this. First, the Anglos in Tucson try to raise a basically a lynch mob to go kill all the Apache. That sort of fades. It doesn't happen. But later, two leaders of Tucson, one Hispanic and one Anglo, raise a group, hundreds of people. A lot of native folks. There are people who have a deep grievance of the Apache. There's some Apache attacks on a farm, a ranch, and they go in and on an early morning they massacre, and there's different counts, but about 125 women and children. Right. Whitman Whitman has gotten the confidence of these people. He knows them. He actually knows who they are and by name. He knows most of the people. And he's tremendously upset. Military is bureaucratic. They don't do anything. He starts writing letters when he doesn't get any response after 6 weeks because the Department of Arizona is controlled by a man named General Stoneman in San Francisco, and he just doesn't want to get involved in this stuff. So Whitman starts raising trouble. He starts writing letter after letter. He's infuriated. He's promised these people safety, and they've been all murdered. And he has to face the men whose women and children have been killed. So he doesn't be a good soldier. He raises a trouble. And they try the people who did the massacre. They're acquitted in 19 minutes. And their argument is it's justifiable homicide. Some Apaches have killed somebody somewhere, and so we have a right to kill all of them.
It's always that.
It's always justified. They don't claim they didn't do it. They say it's justified. And they come up with all kinds of stuff. Well, we followed the Apache trail right back to that camp. But, they knew where the camp was for months. And they just didn't like the idea of this many Apaches around. Whitman claims he's kept a really close eye on him. They couldn't have done the raid. They claim Whitman is a drunkard. He's just falling down drunk. They claim he's fraternizing with Indian women. They basically frame him. And the court-martial him, at first, General Crook, who's now running things, and as a court-martial, General Crook really doesn't want to court-martial him because it's, you know, it's like bullshit. And so what happens next is they have another court-martial, and then they have another court-martial until they finally force him out of the army. If he is just falling down drunk, he goes back to Washington, becomes a successful saddle maker, produces the saddle that's used by the American military, lives until he's 80 years old. So that's what happens, and you can find all of this on different websites of Arizona history. You can find a history of early Arizona, the bloody history of early Arizona, in two books by military men, one by General George Crook, which is called The Autobiography of General George Crook, who built a lot of roads in Arizona, including some of us next to us, and a Brook, and see if I can find his first name here. John G. Brook, on the border with Crook. There's a lot of other sources. Arizona begins with this very dark history of massacre and violence, of war with the people who are so diffuse and so individualistic that there's no chief to make a peace with a lot of times. The bands are, there there was no Arizona, there's no such thing as an Apache. That's a name that was made up. So that's how Arizona starts. Bloody warfare, military seizure of land from, I mean, there's some ambiguity, right, Gary, about Mexico and Arizona, who owns this stuff. But on the other hand, it wasn't exactly taken to a court of law where people balance one side with the other.
Meanwhile, you have settlers bringing in cattle into Apache lands or into Native American lands, and of course the Native Americans occasionally decide to use them for food because they don't have other food, so they're, you know, accused of cattle theft. And then at the same time you have prospectors coming in from all over the country looking for, you know, gold and silver and copper and everything else. So it set up a lot of conflict between the original inhabitants and the American settlers coming
in. And when they send, they go through a lot of changes. They send out Quakers to run the Indian reservations because they can't find anybody who won't steal from the Indians. So they say, well, I'll send them a Quaker. Their guys are honest and they're pacifists. They'll teach you to be kindly and friendly. And nothing seems to work. And back east, they basically don't understand the depth of the violence here. They don't really understand. They think you can just go make peace with the Apache. But if you're honest, what we're doing is destroying them. One way or another, we're destroying the people, and they know it. And so having a little peace conference and stuff, this kind of thing doesn't work. The military wants to defeat them and then force them onto a reservation to save them from the settlers.
Back east, they're reading dime novels that romanticize all of this. And there's this whole feeling of manifest destiny that any people of color are incapable of governing themselves.
That's right. They're children.
So only white people can control them and help them. So we're here to educate them, civilize them, and bring them around to our way of thinking.
And our religion.
And our customs.
And that's how Arizona starts. That's how it starts. And the southern part of Arizona is basically Mexican. Americans move in. And Prescott is almost entirely Anglo settlers from the very beginning. So there's a difference between northern and southern Arizona that exists to this day. Chuck, give us a little history of the state of Arizona and its economic development.
Well, Arizona had trade going on in the period from 500 A.D. to about 1400 A.D. with the original Native American tribes, the Anasazi, the Hohokam, and so on. And there's pretty good evidence of the trade because there, for example, in northern Arizona, there are shells that came from the Pacific. Here in the Verde Valley, we believe that the Sinawa tribes main export goods was salt. There's a salt mine here, and they traded that with the other tribes. But there's little detailed information on that. The first real settlement of the area occurs in the southern Arizona, in the areas that were purchased in the Gladstone Purchase. And it was because they discovered a silver mine near Nogales. And before that, there were very few Spaniards or Mexicans in the state, in what is now the state. They had a mission, San Javier de Bac, a small mission, and a presidio at Tubac. But in order to protect the early silver miners, the Spanish built a couple of forts, including the one in 1776 that became the town of Tucson, or the city of Tucson. Then it was a small town. They built a fortress, and the town grew up beside to do trade, to grow crops to sell to the soldiers and so on. That was attacked four times in major attacks by the Apaches, but because they had fortified walls and muskets and at least one cannon, they were able to hold out even though they were outnumbered, in some cases, 30-40 to 1. And so the town of Tucson became the first substantial-sized community in the state. And its trade was largely with the military base there, and it was a stop on the routes of the Spaniards to settle the missions in California. Arizona itself was very unattractive because it was so arid to the Spaniards, and mostly they came through and settled in California, in coastal California. But the first American known to have arrived in the area were the early trappers. And the first reported written thing is in 1825. Bill Williams and Kit Carson were both part of the original trappers. And so their main deal was to harvest furs and stuff and then ship them back east to St. Louis. And so Bill Williams Mountain and the town of Williams are named after one of those early settlers. Kit Carson later was involved in the wars with the Navajos and was a substantial historical figure. But the economics of it was extracting furs and that sort of activity. Then came the gold rush in California in 1849. And after the gold rush, many of the people who didn't find gold, didn't get a claim they wanted or so on, came back into Arizona and began to prospect. And silver was found in a number of locations, very valuable deposits of silver. But the thing that most made the early history of Arizona, in 1854, copper was discovered by the Arizona Mining Company. And this was the largest copper deposit in the world at the time. And so one of the core foundations of Arizona's economy was copper mining. And there are copper mines in a number of cities around the state. And those copper mines really produced a lot of the early settlers. If you look at the Verde Valley, what we had is Camp Verde was established. And Camp Verde was the first settlers here in Cottonwood and in Camp Verde themselves were selling to the forts. And so that was the main trade here. There was no easy access to outside areas. And so the trade was basically local.
Bert talks about the fact that it's a very long time. It's very late in the game that there are any railroads here or even a telegraph. It's going overland. The stage takes 5 days to get to Los Angeles, where a lot of the state is being managed from.
So in 1855, there was a camp established in what is now Flagstaff. But by 1886, Flagstaff was the largest town on the Santa Fe Railroad connecting Albuquerque with California. And so it was basically a railroad town. They exported lumber. Their agricultural main product was not growing crops, but exporting timber. And the crops often were grown down here in the Verde Valley when we had better access to water and milder climates, and shipped up by mule to Flagstaff, to the lumberjacks and stuff. So all of the trade here was developed some of the trails that we hike in right now were developed in order to get the crops from the Verde Valley up to Flagstaff, which was then a much bigger town because it was the railroad center for northern Arizona.
Reading on the border with Crook, Burke describes the huge primeval forest up on the plateau around Flagstaff that has never been harvested. He describes huge hundreds of year old trees. This is a military officer, and he looks at these trees and he says, old trees are almost like human beings.
Yeah.
He has that same feeling about it. And he says he knows it's all going to be cut down. He knows the value of it. He knows the railroad's coming through. But he sort of regrets the destruction of this huge forest anyway.
So,
and he balances both.
So the Verde Valley communities and Phoenix started about the same time in 1865. They established Fort McDowell and they established Camp Verde. And the communities grew up to provide – remember, they had a regular source of income. They had people that would buy the grain with government money, so they had a crop and a place to sell it. They had a market. So you could live here as a subsistence farmer, but you would end up with no cash. And if you didn't know how to manufacture a plow, which you obviously wouldn't, you couldn't buy one. So you needed to be able to trade with someone who had hard cash, and that was the Army in the early days. So both the Phoenix area – Phoenix was first settled by a group of Hispanic people from Tucson in the same year as the fort, and that was they came up to raise crops to sell to the fort. So the early history of Arizona's business and economy was very much related to the U.S. military, and it turns out it is all through our history, economic history.
So we're not all the sort of lonely, individualistic guys working on our own with no government support or intervention. It's been the Arizona economy has been based on interaction with
the federal government all through its history. So, for example, all the early settlers virtually took advantage of the Homestead Act of 1862, which gave you 160 acres of land free if you would stay on it for 5 years and build a house. And so the Verde Valley was mostly homesteaded by people who got their land from the federal government for free if they were willing to stay there 5 years and build a house on it.
One of the guys I took on a tour said to me, how did the federal government end up owning so much land in Arizona? And I said, well, the federal government owned all the land in the entire western United States, and they either bought it from like the French or they got it by conquest. So at one point, the federal government owned all the land, really controlled all the land in the whole western United States. But the government and people are not not that different. In other words, what Chuck's talking about, if you control all this land with your military, if you don't have anybody living on it, you haven't really gotten control of it.
Yes. The Spaniards never controlled anything in Arizona north of Tucson, really.
Right.
They didn't settle it.
So what's the Arizona economy based on now?
As I mentioned, the copper discovery was one of the cores. And then in the late part of the 19th century, Phoenix established a chamber of commerce, which pushed through we were still a territory then, but pushed through the building of Roosevelt Dam, and so they could have year-round irrigation, and Phoenix only began to grow after it got that. If you look at the year 1900, Phoenix only was smaller than Camp Verde or Sedona or so on. It's about the size of the village of Oak Creek. But after the dam was built, it jumps.
So we're talking about a few thousand people in Phoenix.
Yeah, so you're talking about 5,500 people in Phoenix at the turn of the century. But once you get the agricultural growing by 1940, it's 65,000. Well, that's a pretty big growth at a percentage-wise, but it really doesn't explode until the Second World War. And the fence contractors, there were bases here for interned Japanese, there were prisoner of war bases, and there was a lot of manufacturing of supplies. Remember, we were inland. They were always worried that California could be bombarded by ships from the sea and so on. So this was one of the safest places to build your defense industry. So if you look at what happened after the war, which was also combined with by 1950, this tiny town was 106,000. But by 1960, it was 440,000. So it grew very rapidly during that period in the 50s.
So to sum up, the economy was based almost entirely on interaction. It was like started and energized by interaction with the federal government, buying
freeland
stuff and selling stuff.
In fact, the ranchers who are so proud of their independence and so on had a separate act that gave them 640 acres. But then the common situation was if you had adult children, you had brothers and so on, they claimed adjacent lands. You claimed the land with the water supply, and then you controlled the area. You could lease more lands. If you had the water for your cattle, you could pretty much control a whole large area. So Arizona cattle was one of the foundations of the economy, and that was also from an act similar to the homestead. There was a separate one for grazing land.
Interesting. Let's talk a little bit. Gary, you had some stats about modern Arizona.
When Steve first had the idea to put together a show in Arizona, things that stand out to me about our current situation is Arizona is a very impoverished state. We have the minimum wage here is $7.80 an hour. That tends to be a huge percentage of the population are paid roughly that or slightly more. That means full-time workers are taking home about $16,224 a year. Not taking it home, that's what their overall salary is. Walmart is the largest employer in the state outside the federal government. We've talked before that there's been studies that Walmart is subsidized by the government, and so they get $730 in taxpayer-funded health care for each Walmart worker because their employees are paid so badly. And they get over $1,200 in other forms of public assistance for their workers. And the result is that each Walmart store costs taxpayers, this according to one study, approximately $900,000 per year. So if that's our largest employer, you can see what's going on in the state. Part of the impact of that is we had a show a few weeks back on hunger, and the 2010 census showed that 21.2% of Arizonans are living in poverty. Almost half of the state's single mothers live in poverty, 45.7% actually, compared to 39.9% nationally. Only Mississippi has worse poverty than the state of Arizona. It's tied as the worst state in the U.S. when it comes to child hunger, and the fifth worst for overall food insecurity. 1 in 4 children, 1 in 5 adults, 1 in 7 of the state's seniors struggle with hunger. A total of 888,000 unduplicated Arizonans, meaning, different Arizonans, received emergency food assistance in 2009, the latest figures I could find. And 49% of the households receiving food assistance have someone who is working. The rest are primarily elderly or disabled. So we have some major issues. When you talk about the economy, it really is a problem.
And the wealth and poverty is not at all evenly spread out. So the per capita income in Arizona is below the national average, about 25,000. But if you look here at the Verde Valley, the per capita income in Cornville is 16,500. In Cottonwood is 17,500. In Sedona, it's above the state and national average at 31,000. But if you look at the little town of Paradise Valley, it's 81,000. So there's a wide discrepancy in our communities in what the average per capita income is.
Yeah, I think that people don't. So there's a huge group of people that have a lot of money. Right. There are the huge multi-million dollar houses all over Phoenix. But there's also the sort of the poverty and the maldistribution of wealth. What causes this? Is there an economic engine? Is there something about the Arizona economy that causes this to be exaggerated over, you know, some place, I don't know where, Vermont?
One thing I think is true about the Arizona economy is a lot of the wealth in Paradise Valley or in Sedona, for that matter, wasn't made here. It was made in more prosperous places and brought here by retirees or people building second homes or so on and so forth. But good paying jobs in the Verde Valley are pretty rare, and good paying jobs in Phoenix are more common, but not well below the national average.
What drives the Arizona economy that produces the kind of thing that Gary's talking about?
Well, of course, historically, it's not one of our five C's, but it's really been construction. Phoenix grew and was populated by people who were building houses for other people who were coming there because they were building houses and shopping centers for those people and so on. And that's always been cyclical. We had a whole series of crashes. When I moved to Arizona in the 80s, property in the neighborhood I bought was down 30% from its highs. I bought a house 30% less than the previous owners had paid for that same house. And we, of course, we repeated that and even more so in recent years where property values dropped 50%. Because if you build your economy on real estate booms and busts, it's virtually guaranteed that you'll have big slumps periodically. The 80s one was created by the failure of the SNLs and their overinvestment in real estate.
The other part of reason, I think, behind the low salaries, low wages, is the dependence on in much of Arizona on tourism and retail. These are jobs that don't pay a lot, generally. You know, it's a lot of service workers that are paid minimum wage in kitchens and as servers, and it's a lot of people working in retail jobs that are not paid a great deal.
Gary mentioned poverty, Mike. What's our situation in terms of education here? Because education and having a vibrant center, I mean, you can look at Austin in Texas.
Yeah, forget it. Education in Arizona is it's an interesting hodgepodge. And once again, it's going to be a talk about money. Even though people feel like, at least the people in charge, that throwing money at education won't help. Well, yeah, it would. It really would. We when you're third from the bottom, and the education statistics in Arizona are
appalling.
Bottom. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
This apparently wealthy state that people drive around it. They see a lot more of the fancy houses than the impoverished areas.
Well, one of the things, you can't talk about education in Arizona without talking about charter schools. And this is a headline from last month's Ford magazine. Charter school gravy train runs express to Fat City. And what they're talking about is investments in charter schools, not only in Arizona, but nationwide, and specifically one of the latest places is Florida. But charter schools in Arizona, and I remember when they began in the mid-90s, we have the oldest and the most right here.
What's wrong with charter schools?
Nothing. They just are not as effective as they'd like to be. I have relatives in charter schools, and they're doing very, very well. In other words, it's a good school, but it could be a good public school, too. It's not good because it's a charter school. The idea of charter schools was to create these educational laboratories free from the regular, you know, the crushing government regulations so that education could be let go and make all these innovations.
Why is it a gravy train then?
Because it's for profit. You get a cut of the property taxes. Forbes says this is yet one more way that you can get a cut of other people's property taxes, and investors see that, and they say you can double your money in 7 years by investing in a charter school because you have that tax money rolling in support of this private school, basically. And my problem in Arizona, one of
taxpayers pay for the charter schools in Arizona, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
That's it. They're publicly, so you can't call them. It becomes a semantics game. You can't call them private. You can't call them public. But they're publicly funded private schools.
So the taxpayers fund the schools, but they don't actually control the schools.
That's right. And in 10 years in Arizona, the owner of the charter school gets. This is what. And then please, if somebody's listening to this and they know this isn't true, then call. Or stop me on the street, or buy me a drink. But you get title to the property that of the school that you bought with tax money after 10 years. You run a successful charter school for 10 years, you own it, even though it was bought and supported with public tax money. Now, we're talking, so you can't, like I say, the one thing that charter school, now, the studies show that they don't teach you to read any better. They don't teach you to write any better. They don't teach you to math any better than public schools do. The only thing they do very well is they limit the influence of teachers' unions extremely well. And they make money for their investors. We have an expert here, a financial expert. When charter schools law was passed and all the stuff began happening, how many other businesses? We're talking about Main Street and Cottonwood. Within 200 yards of Main Street and Cottonwood, there are 8 of the same kind of business. In other words, there's 8 charter schools opened up within 5 years. What other kind of business would open up if it wasn't extremely profitable? You can drive down. I don't know about Sedona. I know about Cottonwood. I can tell you where they are. We know the names of them. They all opened up. And this is in Cottonwood.
So this is taking money from public schools.
Forget about Gilbert. Forget about, and you know, the Charter School Board is headquartered in Higley, down in that whole East Valley where that was at massive growth. And certainly, now let's not think, though, this is unusual for me. I'm going to do a bipartisan thing here. Lest we think this is a Republican thing. Going after government money is a Republican thing. They supply the friends. The other thing, the Goldwater Institute of all people, it was the Morrison Institute, found out that charter schools get a lot of their supplies from the board members of charter schools. One of the ways to increase your business is to become a board member of a charter school
in
Arizona.
We have to do a whole program on this. We might get something.
I don't know. I think I'm covering it. It's not that deep. I'm covering it right now.
But why does this drain public schools? It drains the taxpayer. It drains tax.
Right. The direction I was going to was that it is rural Republicans and urban Democrats are often in favor of charter schools because they want an alternative to public education, and certainly in some inner cities. And my position would be, you know what? Support the public school. Support the school that doesn't have limited enrollment, that doesn't do limited administrative things. As far as I could see, the reason charter schools were started was to keep your religious teachings in your school. It was to keep keep Anglo sons and daughters from rubbing elbows with brown sons and daughters, because you could limit admissions was the whole idea.
And cherry pick the students, right?
Exactly.
And the tax credit to answer your question about why charter schools, what they do in terms of taxes taking away from public schools. Charter schools get a different deal when it comes to tax credits. Individuals can donate twice as much to charter schools and get a tax credit right off the top of what they were supposed to pay for taxes. It's twice as much for a charter school, as I understand, as it is for a public school.
But Arizonans don't want to spend very much money on schools, whether they're charter schools or public schools.
Well, yeah, and from the Capital Times, we cut deepest or third deepest. Oklahoma cut and Alabama in the last 4 years. Now, my position also is before 2008, Arizona already started really low. So I think Arizona has lost more in education than any other state. But when you start counting in 2008, then we did the third deepest cuts, regardless of what rank we are, cutting $3 billion out of education in 4 years. public, private, everything in between, cutting $2.8 billion out of education in 4 years.
It was 17% of the budget.
Is devastating beyond my ability to describe it here in five shows. But I am going to read one more paragraph from Forbes. It said, wealthy individuals from as far away as China, Nigeria, Russia, and Australia are spending tens of millions of dollars to build classrooms, libraries, basketball courts, and science labs in American charter schools, says a 2012 Reuters report. Now, why are they doing this? It's because there's money to be made in the for-profit education business.
So they've turned what was a public responsibility to educate children, and I think we've said before, there's nothing more important in our view, I think we all agree, than the education of our kids.
Well,
and they've turned that into a money-making thing.
To socialists like me, the state's responsibility is to educate, incarcerate, and medicate. That's what governments are for, as far as I'm concerned. So, yes.
You want a medicated population?
We're not going there. A single payer healthcare plan is, I heard somebody else, a bunch of Republicans believe that the whole Obama thing was with ACA, the Affordable Healthcare, was a plot to have it all screwed up. And then in any day now, he's going to come out with a single payer plan. Have you heard this one?
It's hard to keep up with the Republican plots.
I think it would be a great idea.
I do,
but
too.
I don't think it's going to happen. I think that's all fantasy.
So to get back to education.
I want to say one more thing, that the way, if you're concerned about this, and we seem to run into an awful lot of people related on this show or talk about this show that are concerned about education, there's little you can do locally. It's not like Connecticut or Massachusetts where you have a local budget. All your activism must be at the state level. Most of it has to be at the state level. Sedona just passed its override, which is one of the ways we'll talk about school funding sometimes when you're really, really, if insomnia is a problem and you want to take a nap at 8:15, we'll talk about school funding here on Democratic Perspective. But the idea is that, the activism is what passed the Sedona override and the Cottonwood Oak Creek override and the Mingus override. As we said, all overrides on this side of the mountain passed, overrides on the other side of the mountain, meaning Prescott failed, Prescott Valley failed.
There's one statistic I'd like to get out about education that I think is really telling, too, is that according to statistics from 2006, it's the most recent that I could find, only 19% of all 2006 high school graduates in Arizona completed college within 6 years. So to me, that shows a couple of things. It shows, number one, that our population isn't being educated for the 21st century, that they're not going to be able to take advantage of a lot of the better paying jobs. Number two, it demonstrates the effects of poverty, because you have to assume that a lot of these people aren't finishing college because they simply can't afford to.
Almost all the graduates from college come from 50% of the schools in Arizona. In other words, we've talked about this before, but there's not a way to move up. So the poorer schools are not producing college graduates. There's no move up into the economy. People are stuck in one kind of situation or another. Everybody want to sum up? We've got a couple of minutes left. Any last words and thoughts?
We presented this morning statistics and information on the Arizona economy and Arizona education. Those two things are so tied together as to be, you think it would be obvious to legislators that if you're trying to get Apple or somebody to move here and to get industry here, to get things, then you need a strong education system. You can say, we support. How do you support? You support stuff with money. That this is America. We don't want to hear nice words. I don't want to. And Arizona teachers are doing a great job with very little. I don't want you to tell me what a good guy I am. I don't want you to thank me for my service. I want you to pay me just like they did this banker.
He's pointing at my brother here, who managed huge sums of money for a major independent bank.
There is a door breakfast this Thursday. Diana Post is going to be speaking. It's at the Old Sedona Bar and Grill. You can find information about it on the DOOR website. It's on private prisons. And the kind of thing that Mike is talking about, and Chuck, and particularly Gary, is that we have a private prison system that costs more than public prisons do. Why are we doing that?
Come Thursday and find out.
And listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.